Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So in American history and culture, we have our famous war heroes from the Civil War, from the Revolutionary War, World War I and World War II. These were men who were celebrated for their acts of bravery in the battlefield, people like Sergeant York, George Washington, etc. But it seems like these two most recent wars we've been involved in, the Afghanistan War and the war in Iraq, we don't really have those sort of superstar heroes. But the thing is, there's some really heroic things going on. There's some men who are doing just amazing things in just dire situations. And our guest today wanted to find out why that is, and he wanted to correct that. His name is Mark Lee Greenblatt, and he is the author of the book Valor, Unsung Heroes from Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Homefront. And in today's podcast, Mark and I talk about, like, why don't we know more about some of these brave men who are fighting overseas and some of the things that they've done. And then we talk about some of the men that he writes about in his book and what they did and their acts of bravery and valor that they displayed. And then we also talk about what lessons we can learn from these men. So it's a fascinating podcast. I hope you tune in. It's going to be a good one. Mark Greenblatt, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Brett. I got to tell you before we start that I am such a huge, huge fan of The Art of Manliness. I listen to podcasts all the time. Steve Pressfield's interview was great about the turning pro and the Battle of Thermopylae and everything like that. It's just, this is great. This is one of my favorite things to listen to. So it's a real honor to be on.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very humbled. So your book is called Valor, Unsung Heroes from Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Homefront. First off, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, back in 2007 and 2008, I went to these awards banquets where they honored military heroes, and they would recite the stories of what these men and women had done, and they were just unbelievable. There was not a dry eye in the house when at these big gala events. Everyone's crying about how amazing, how inspirational they were. And I remember thinking to myself, how come no one knows these guys? How come, you know, they'll be lucky to be bagging groceries if they get a job in the first place? Whereas in the past, war heroes came home and they were household names, and we had ticker tape parades for them in their communities, and we really had gotten away from that. And I set out to change that. I said, these people, we need to know their stories. We need to know their names. And that was really the moment when I said, this is something I've got to do.
So why do you think, I was wondering that too, as I was reading these stories of these men in combat, I kept on wondering, like, why haven't I heard about these guys? Because you hear, there's a few that I know about, but for the most part, I don't know. Back in World War I and World War II, war heroes were household names. Like, they even make movies about them, like, during the actual war, while the war was still going on, ticker tape parades. So why is it that these past two wars, the one in Iraq and Afghanistan, failed to produce the superstar war heroes? Because it's not anything that the men have done. Like, they're doing heroic things, but something's going on the home front that's not allowing that to happen.
Right. I think it generally boils down to two, maybe more factors, but the two that pop into my mind instantly are politics and the focus of the media, frankly. These wars were generally very political, particularly Iraq. And, if you think back to those days, 2005, 2006, 2007, those are dark days, I think, in American history, particularly when you talk about the wars. And the debate was really frenzied and really nasty. And amidst that turmoil, I think stories of selflessness became passé. You know, heroes were sort of old news, and it was sort of romanticized to go the other way and find the stories that were bad. And that was the balance that I was trying to fix. I felt that it had gotten out of whack, that people would know very few American soldiers who were serving overseas, and the few that they did know were for bad reasons, like Lindy England in the Abu Ghraib scandal, or for controversial reasons, like, you know, Pat Tillman or Jessica Lynch. We had no one that was just like Audie Murphy or Sergeant York in World War I. And that was exactly the void I was trying to fill. And the other thing was the media. I think there was showing these kinds of stories, these positive stories, were viewed in the media as being biased in favor of the war and sort of propping up the Bush administration at a time when that was, I think, very passé. And so I think that was, those two things really created an atmosphere where stories of heroism just got lost.
Yeah. Do you think we're also, as a culture, uncomfortable with violence for good purposes? I mean, even if it's used for good, do you think we're sort of uncomfortable kind of lauding, you know, war exploits?
I think that's a part of that. I would say that there's violence all around us. I mean, you look at the movies and video games, you know, in a way we've become desensitized to that sort of violence. I think there's also another factor that might be at play, which is that we have a bit of a disconnect between the folks who serve and their families and the folks who don't. And I think that disconnect, you know, back in the day, everyone knew, you know, someone who was serving. You know, it was either the guy down the block or someone in your own family. Whereas now I think there's a chasm between those who are serving and those who aren't. And so those folks don't have it in front of them and aren't so committed to knowing these stories and publicizing these stories. And so I think that's a third factor that really goes into why these names are not, you know, household names like in years past.
Okay. I think I remember reading, and maybe I read this incorrectly, but do we give fewer medals for valor during the two most recent wars than we did in previous wars? And if so, why is that?
Yeah, I don't know about in toto, in terms of all of the medals, but certainly with respect to the Medal of Honor, which is the one that gets the most notoriety, I mean, you know, the most attention and really kind of frames, you know, the perception of these things in the American public, certainly those are way off. In World War II, I think it was one per 35,000. And in the last two wars, it's something along the lines of one per every 115,000. So it's dramatically different. And part of the problem is the nature of the battles that we're facing, at least this is what I've read, is that DOD regs say that the Medal of Honor has to involve enemy combatants. And so when someone does something heroic in the face of, say, an IED attack, there's no actual enemy combatant. And so for a while, I believe that held up or at least skewed the medals of honor, versus in previous combat. And I think there's an effort to change that or review that, because that's really kind of changing the numbers and therefore changing the perception of the wars in the way that we're talking about.
Okay. Another thing, as I was reading this, reminded me, because before I read Sebastian Younger's War, and then your book reminded me of it, is just the tactical difficulty of these two most recent wars. And I don't think a lot of Americans understand what our fighting soldiers are facing, or what they faced over there, and in some cases still facing today. How were the two most recent wars different from previous wars that we've been in?
Well, I think the big thing is that we're not fighting a known enemy in the sense that they're not wearing uniforms and they're not using sort of typical battle tactics. They're just popping up as snipers in the middle of the street and using IEDs in a way that I think is different from previous engagements, at least on the scale that we're seeing. And that has had a dramatic impact. One thing that the impact on the guys is that you can never really let your guard down. We've had so many infiltrations where purportedly friendly forces are then turning their weapons on Americans that our guys can't really put their guard down. So there's no downtime, and that keeps them on edge for long, long periods of time. And so I think that has, over the long haul, a really detrimental effect. At least what I heard was that it was really hard just keeping your mind engaged at all times. I mean, that gets old after a year-long deployment. And so I think that change is really having an impact, and that's hurting them when they come back. I think that's very difficult for them to deal with when they come back because they're always on edge, always looking for a long period of time, looking around the corner, looking at that debris in the street, wondering whether that's an IED. And so when they're walking down the street in their hometown, they're reminded of these things, and so it's constantly on their brain. And I think that weighs on them, and that really has had a dramatic impact.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the Iraq War was a little more of a traditional war where there was an army perhaps, but like the war in Afghanistan, that was just crazy. I mean, like, first off, Afghanistan is like the environment there is just crazy. It's one of the most harshest places on earth. And then you have like you describe some of the encounters, and they happen in these little small villages that have these winding goat trails. And you really can't see what's coming at you. I mean, it just really, when I was reading that, I couldn't imagine being in those guys' place.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the other thing that is that, if you think about World War I, World War II, our guys were going over to Western Europe. They can appreciate Western Europe. They may not speak the language, but they know what a bakery looks like. They know, what's going on, in the streets and the signs, and, they can get some semblance of what's happening. Whereas when you're in a rural village in Afghanistan, that is as far away as you can get. I mean, one of the guys that I interviewed described the landscape as like walking on the moon. He was like literally in a different place in the universe from what he was familiar with. And I think doing that over and over again with languages that are so different and the cultural experiences are so different. I mean, they couldn't really relate to the people, the goat herders that they were interacting with. And I think that really over time just really weighs on the guys in a way that's different from previous wars where you can understand the terrain better. Your brain is working less actively because you know what the church looks like and that sort of thing. And so I think that has another impact as well.
So we'll get into some of the specific stories here in a bit. But before we do that, what did all the men who you included in your book have in common? Or, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is like, what traits gave them valor and made them a hero?
There are two things that really emerge. One is this sense of brotherhood, this selflessness, this teamwork. It's overwhelming when you talk to these guys, and the nine that I profiled, but also the other folks that I interviewed, the other men and women that were in the stories. This sense of brotherhood is unlike anything we see in civilian life. I mean, the willingness to do anything, literally anything, to save your buddy, it is just—it's sort of awe-inspiring, and I mean that in the actual, real way. Like it inspired awe in me that they were so willing to do anything for each other. It was just a fascinating, characteristic that I tried to convey to the readers. I really tried to put them in their minds and convey that just their willingness to do so because I don't think we can appreciate it. The second thing is in each of the stories, the men had these moments amidst the maelstrom going on around them where they were in relative safety. And what I mean by that is like the bullets weren't firing directly at them. They were inside the building when the shots were being fired in the alleyway immediately outside, that sort of thing. But in each of the stories, the heroes decided to put themselves in greater danger. They left that position of relative safety and put themselves in greater danger. in order to save a life or accomplish a mission. And that moment was fascinating to me. I had to find out more about that. And so I really slowed down time. And, you know, I was asking these guys, I mean, minute by minute, second by second, what are you thinking then? What's happening then? What's happening then? And tried to place the reader in their bodies, in their minds, as these dire circumstances are unfolding, and say, what is making you think about going into that, into the sniper's fire, or jumping into this swirling water in the middle of the Atlantic, in the middle of this horrific storm? You know, what's making you jump in there and do that? And that was just a fascinating moment, and that was what I tried to capture for the readers.
Well, you did a good job capturing both the brotherhood and why these men made the decisions that they did. And yeah, I'll be honest, when I was reading these stories talking about brotherhood, and something we've talked about on the site before, like talking about honor, right? This idea that you it's all about caring for your brotherhood and being concerned about your status within the group. And that means putting the team before you. And that was another common thread I saw among these guys. Like, it was the team before self.
That's right. And that's right. It was self-sacrifice. Yeah.
Yeah. And as I was reading these stories, like, I'll admit, like, I was like, man, I want to sign up just so I can experience that sort of brotherhood. Because, like, I'll be honest, I don't think I've ever experienced anything like that or close to it. Maybe it's something, you know, on a small magnitude, but I'm sort of envious in a way of these men who had that experience. I don't envy, like, the, you know, being and, you know, having to worry about IEDs, but I envy that sense of camaraderie and brotherhood. And I think a lot of men probably want that in their life too.
Absolutely. I mean, I felt the exact same way. I said, you know, there's that envy that, you know, you're just like, wow, that is so captivating that you can be part of something that you would literally die for. I mean, that is just mind-boggling, and I was so inspired by that. And you know, one of the stories involves a guy named James Hassel, who literally carried a mortally injured guy through crossfire. And, you know, both of them said they weren't particularly close. It wasn't like they were best friends. It wasn't like they had grown up together. It wasn't like they were, you know, soulmates or anything like that. But James was like, that's my teammate, and I am not going to let him die. And Chris Kyle, of one of the Navy SEALs, he didn't even know the guy that he saved. And he put himself in extraordinary danger, literally liberating a group of Marines he did not know, you know, and single-handedly pushing off insurgent snipers to liberate them. I mean, just a captivating moment. And he didn't even know them. It was just that sort of generic team that he was a part of. And I just found that just so overwhelming.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that had it cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box, and I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chop sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products, as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at texaspete.com. That's podcast 24 for 20% off at texaspete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea that self-sacrifice forces you to, when you're doing something for others, you push yourself beyond your limits, I feel like. Because I feel like in America, at least right now, there's this sort of idea that, oh, I want self-fulfillment, I want to become the best me, and it's all about doing stuff for yourself. Right, you do like, you know, you meditate or you exercise, but you don't really do it for anybody else. But like in my experience, when I'm doing something, when I'm trying to serve another person, whether it's my family or the people I write for, like that pushes me beyond what I think I'm capable of.
Absolutely, and that's borne out in all of these stories. I mean, it's exactly that. They're willing to do more for someone else. One of the guys, James Hassell, the Marine I was talking about earlier. He said that the fear wasn't dying himself. He was sort of over that. The fear was that he would do something wrong or not do enough, and that would result in someone else, another Marine, dying. He said that was the motivation to do anything. It wasn't about himself. He said, if I died, but I saved other Marines in doing so, I would be successful. I would be happy with that. And just a mind-boggling concept. And that was something that's just so inspiring. I mean, exactly what you're talking about. They're willing to do so much more on behalf of their teammates than perhaps even for themselves.
Yeah, that example right there is a perfect example of just traditional honor, right? Like it's all about the team. That's what honor is. And I think in America and in the West, like most civilians don't understand that sort of honor. Like for us, honor is like integrity, personal integrity. I live by my code, but honor in the sense that what the Romans talked about and what Theodore Roosevelt talked about, that still exists in combat today. It's really cool. Here's a question I have. How did you get these men to open up about their stories? Because most soldiers, particularly ones who have been awarded medals or distinctions for combat or for valor, they're very hesitant to talk about it. They're very humble. They'll just say things like, oh, I was just doing my job. But your stories are very detailed, like you said. So how did you get them to open up and talk?
Well, first of all, I should say none of them wanted to tell their story. They all said exactly what you're talking about. I'm not a hero. I did what anyone else would have done. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And frequently they said, I'm not the hero. It's the guy next to me that was the hero. So, I mean, it's just stunning how, and they really believe it, by the way. This was not some sort of like talking points that they have. They really genuinely believe it. And so they bristle when I would use the term hero. In fact, I frequently would not use the term hero or heroic or anything like that. I would just say, you know, it's pretty cool what you did, you know, and can you tell me about it? But in order to get them to participate in the project, it was very difficult. I basically had to, you know, beg and plead with them, and to get them to tell their story. And what I told them was, and I wasn't playing fast and loose or anything like that. I was very obvious about it. I said, look, you know, these stories need to be told, and it's not about you and your story. It's about using your story as an example for what everyone's doing, for what all the tens of thousands of men and women are doing overseas. And in order to spread the word about what all of you are doing, I need to tell some stories, and yours is one. And I think they believed in that. Again, it was shifting it away from them as an individual and more about the group. And they believed in that. And the other thing was that, you know, I told them that I am donating a significant portion of the proceeds to military and veterans-related charities. So I think that helped them, get over the fact that they were, you know, didn't want to hold themselves out as being exceptional, but they would do it for a better cause, maybe. So I think that helped. But in terms of, like, actually sharing the details, which I think is part of your question as well, I'm a trained investigator. This is what I do for a living. I'm an attorney, and I conduct investigations. And I've done that for a long time. And so these were akin to depositions witness interviews that I've done, you know, a large number of times. And so what I did was I treated it like that, where I would, interview them and drill down into the details and extract as much information from them as possible. And one of the guys told his wife, this guy doesn't get it. He keeps asking me the same question over and over again. And that's, you know, one of my standard tactics is keep asking. There's always more there. And that was it. It was basically deposing them and asking them, you know, difficult questions. And I will give them all huge credit, because they all stuck with me. They all answered my questions. They never said no. They never bristled at the questions. There was a lot of crying. There was a lot of very difficult moments, crying by them, crying by me. I was so moved by what they were telling me. These stories of, you know, individuals, you know, literally dying in their arms. I mean, you get choked up just hearing it. And it was really emotional. There are also some really funny moments too. I mean, some, you know, laugh out loud funny moments where I had to stop the recorder for a second because I was chuckling so loud. It was just a wide range of emotions. But getting the details from them was no easy feat, let me tell you.
Well, I'm glad you were persistent, because I feel fortunate to have read these stories. So let's get into give people a taste of what's in your book. Are there any stories in particular that stand out to you, or were some of your personal favorites? I know it's like picking children, but what's a story in the book that you particularly like?
Well, yeah, as you said, it is like picking children. I couldn't possibly, like, you know, folks have asked me, do I have a favorite? No, yeah. I mean, I love them all. I do actually have some level of love for these guys. I mean, I feel a kinship with them. But there are a couple of stories that are interesting on multiple different levels, and I think that's what gets me a little bit. Like one guy, Mike Waltz. He was a Special Forces Commander, a Reserve Special Forces Commander, who was leading a squad in a very remote village in Afghanistan. And they had heard word there were insurgents there, and Mike had was leading his squad through the village doing a regular patrol. And they had been paired up with an Afghan unit. And Mike had grown to really admire the sergeant major of the Afghan unit, and this guy Sumar. And he really respected him, and he got to know him, and you know, he asked Sumar, he said, well, you know, why are you in the army? Putting yourself and your family at risk. And he said, you know, essentially that he was doing it so that he could give his children a better life and you know, have his sons, you know, earn enough money so that his sons wouldn't have to go to the madrasas where they would get fundamentalized, you know, radicalized. And so Mike, you know, grew to love this guy, and it was really interesting, and they had developed this sort of relationship, even though they were going through an interpreter this whole time. Fast forward, you know, to the next day, and they're on a patrol, and there's an ambush. And, you know, machine guns mowing them down. And Mike stands up, and he is literally firing against these two machine guns that are very, very close, essentially point-blank range. And Mike is standing there in the middle of this riverbed, shooting back at them with just a pistol. He's not wearing his helmet. He doesn't have any grenades, and he is firing back with a pistol. I mean, it's this, if you get the image in your mind, it's unbelievable. One of the medic that was in his unit, who was standing there watching all this, said he, when he looked from his perspective, they were so close that the fire from the machine guns and from Mike's gun were essentially touching. That's how close they were.
Wow.
And I'm just so captivating this moment. But then here's the part, it gets even better. So Mike eventually dives for cover behind this little tiny stone wall. And he saw that Sumar had gotten shot. And so he runs out into the kill zone, right? He, you know, the insurgents could start firing at any moment, but Mike runs out into the kill zone and grabs Sumar, and he's dragging him back into behind this wall, trying to protect him. And as he's dragging him, Sumar, he hears his last breath. He hears Sumar die in his hands, in his arms. And it was, you know, obviously a tragic moment. Fast forward a bit, they survive that firefight. And Mike later heard that Sumar's family had to send their kids to the madrasas because they couldn't afford the other schools. And so Mike, on his own, spending his own money, began to support Sumar's family. He would wire money. He figured out this way to wire money to a remote Afghan family in order to pull those boys out of the madrasa so that they wouldn't be radicalizing even more kids. And Mike has been giving them money, you know, for years now, and he's never met them. He just knew Sumar. And I just found that so captivating, not just the fact that he was fighting against these machine guns at essentially point-blank range with a pistol, but that he would do all that. He would run back in and try to save Sumar's life and then literally support the family all on his own money. I just found that overwhelming and just so inspiring.
Yeah, that was one of my favorites. I mean, all of them are great, but that one really touched me. I mean, there's so many. So there's how many? There's nine total stories.
Nine total, and I could talk about each one of them like that. I mean, that you know, it just the thing about, you know, supporting the family just kind of kicked it up a notch. If folks are going to hear about any one story, I think that's a good one to hear about. But I'm happy to talk about the others. I mean, one of the guys we had talked about, James Hassel, earlier, and Marine Grunt, who was in an awful firefight in Najaf. And one of his comrades, like I said, was awfully injured by shrapnel from one of the insurgents. And they knew he was going to die if they didn't get him to the medevac unit. The medevac unit was about 100 yards down an alley. The problem was there were insurgents shooting directly into that alley. And so they said, we got to get Ryan out. And James reached his hand up and said, throw him on my back. Throw him on my back. That's what he said, right then and there, no hesitation. And that's what they did. And James, as he's about to leave this building, go out into the crossfire, you know, where insurgents are literally shooting right down where he would be running, he fought back to a promise that he had made his mother, that he was going to come back to from Iraq in one piece. And he actually thought to himself at that moment, I'm about to break that promise. He thought he was going to die, but he wasn't going to let Ryan die. He was at least going to give it a shot. And that's what he thought he's going to run into this alley. And then he goes and he runs down, and I try to slow down time and present each step essentially as he's running down this alley. Long story short, he saved Ryan's life. He literally saved Ryan's life by carrying him down that alley to the helicopter. And I had these amazing moments. I had this interview with Ryan about what it was like to be carried on James's back as the bullets are ringing out. And he was pretty sure he was going to die, not just from the shrapnel, but from getting shot. Just the, you know, just the moment of when they turned the corner away from the shooting, you know, just this celebratory moment was pretty cool. It was a pretty good story. You know, as you know, because you've read the book, it's got a bit of a tragic ending.
Yeah.
Because James, after he left the Marine Corps, came home and at 30 years old, out of nowhere, he just collapsed in his kitchen one day over Labor Day weekend. And tragic story. He never came to. And his wife, he's survived by a beautiful wife and lovely 4-year-old daughter. It's just a tragic story that he could do something so heroic, so amazing overseas, literally saving lives. But then he, had his life tragically cut short. And, there's an amazing coda on top of that, frankly, that he was an organ donor. And his wife just told me not too long ago that James's organs were then donated to a number of people. And she heard back that his organs actually saved 4 people's lives.
Wow.
So even in death, James Hassell was saving lives. Pretty incredible, pretty inspirational.
That's amazing. Well, I mean, we could talk about each of them, but I don't want to because I want people to go out there and get your book and read these stories for themselves. I can imagine that talking to these men and then writing their stories down has changed you. How has writing this book made you a better man?
A couple of different ways. There are lessons from these guys, and I've really tried to incorporate them. One of them is, perspective, frankly. A couple of these guys, I mean, all of them believed they were going to die at some point during the stories that I tell, the incidents that I describe. And I actually think about what they were going through in my moments of stress. And they seem so small, so petty. There was one guy who Dan Foster, who single-handedly held off an insurgent ambush of his little remote outpost, and he had suffered major, major injuries. And he looked in a mirror at one point back in the medic's tent, and he saw these awful injuries to his face. He lost 13 teeth, substantial bone structure in his upper and lower jaws. I mean, it was a disaster. It was awful. But Dan went back into the fight after he saw those injuries in the mirror. And so when I'm having a difficult time with my first world problems, I actually think about the moment that Dan Foster looked in the mirror and went back into the fight. So when you ask how have I changed, how has this improved my life, I think I've gotten some perspective where, before, if my Wi-Fi went down, I would get really pissed. But now I actually think about Dan Foster and I try to get a bit of perspective on the situation, that my problems aren't so bad. And, I think about these guys, Chris Choe, Army paratrooper who was in Afghanistan, earned a Silver Star at one point, did something truly incredible, and he called it the loneliest moment of my life. He thought he was going to die. And, I think about that when some idiot cuts me off in traffic and I'm about to lose my cool. I actually think about Chris Choe, about how he didn't lose his cool in the loneliest moment of his life when he thought he was going to die. And he then proceeded to do something incredible and heroic. I actually try to think about those guys and incorporate their experiences in my life to make me a better person. And I think that's a good lesson for all of us, frankly. A bit of perspective really will kind of make you, reduce the stress, make things, roll like water off a duck's back a bit more in our lives.
Very good. Well, our time is coming to an end. There's so much more we could talk about, but where can people find out more about your book, Valor?
On my website, markleegreenblatt.com. And one very cool feature about it, which I invite everyone to use, is I have set it up that folks can go on and email directly with the heroes. So they can email, the guys that we talked about, Mike Waltz, Chris Choe, all the folks we talked about. And, there are two of them, James and Chris Kyle, passed away since they returned home. But folks can email their families. And I would invite people to reach out and share their thoughts about hearing their stories and, feel free to ask questions or even if they just want to say thanks. These are great guys and I know they would want to hear from people. And I think they'll interact. So I would invite you to, go on and shoot them an email and you'll probably get a response.
That's awesome. Mark Greenblatt, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Brett. This has been great.
Our guest today was Mark Greenblatt. He is the author of the book Valor, Unsung Heroes from Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Home Front. You can find that on Amazon.com or bookstores everywhere. Also, make sure to check out his website, markleegreenblatt.com, and you can actually email some of the heroes that he highlights in his book Valor. Pretty cool thing. So it's markgreenblatt.com. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And again, if you enjoy this podcast, you've gotten something out of it, I'd really appreciate it if you take the time to give us a review on iTunes or Stitch or whatever. That would help us get the word out about the podcast and let more people know about it. So yeah, please do that. Until next time, stay manly.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.